today, Promoter versus Pollard, 092292. All right, is that Ms. or Mrs. Morsehead?
Morsehead.
Ms. Morsehead. Okay, you may proceed.
At the center of this appeal is what the Wisconsin courts have described as the paramount importance of the integrity of the sentencing process, and really the extent to which that integrity was tainted in this case, and the extent to which Mr. Promoter can get relief from that, from this court. This appeal is really the culmination of Mr. Promoter's requests merely to be sentenced based on what he actually did. It is a request that he has made in full recognition, I think, of the fact that what he actually did was a terrible thing. But
well, I had a question about the kind of relief you're seeking here. The brief asked for resentencing, but isn't it clear from the post-conviction order that the court would have imposed this very same sentence even if the number of beers had been different?
I think
we have this 23 versus 9 to 15 by your expert, the amount of alcohol that your client had consumed before this horrendous crash.
It is certainly clear enough that, because we have this unusual situation where the sentencing court can sort of subjectively weigh in on what was in his mind at the time of sentencing, it's certainly clear enough that the sentencing court said, in hindsight, subjectively, I wouldn't have done anything differently. That is true. That doesn't end the discussion. And the reason it doesn't end the discussion really is because it's belied by the record in this case, the record of what actually happened and what the court actually said at sentencing. This is a situation where the difference between the false information that was presented and what actually happened, it's a really significant difference, and the kind of difference you would expect any sentencing judge to pay close attention to. Because here, the judge was told, and actually, interestingly, the judge wasn't told. The number came from the judge's own calculation, the math that the judge did to come up with that 23-beer figure. The judge figured out how many beers he believed had been consumed based on the incorrect information that had been presented. And the judge took that information and really seized upon that information that this man had had 23 beers before getting in his car and driving. And it's the kind of information you would expect the judge to seize upon because it's really highly inflammatory information. I mean, the very idea that this man sat down and drank 23 beers before getting in his car really bespeaks a shocking degree of recklessness. I think depraved conduct is almost not too strong a description of what that 23 beer figure suggests. And so you have the difference between somebody who commits an OWI that results in tragedy, somebody who drinks too much alcohol and makes that decision to drive his car, and somebody who engages in almost what suggests sort of fraternity-type hazing conduct, sitting down to basically guzzle down as many beers as he possibly can before getting in his car. And it's a distinction. It's a very real distinction. And I think it's clear from the record that it's a distinction that was not lost on the sentencing judge at the time of sentencing.
Well, at the time the judge at the sentencing, the actual sentencing, now we're not talking about the post-conviction motion, the judge repeated that 23 beer figure two or three times. Nobody corrected him.
It's true.
I mean, defense counsel didn't say, no, judge, you're off on your calculation. You know, it really should be 9 to 13. We know that the defense expert testified to that, right?
That's right.
So nobody alerted the court to that.
That is true, that no one alerted the court to that issue. And that goes to the whole question of waiver and procedural default, which is a separate question. And I guess I think the court is preferring that I speak to that first, so I will. I'm not sure how much I need to say about the question of procedural default here, because what has been argued is that the state had a waiver rule that was an adequate and independent state law ground that insulates this case from habeas review. And it's difficult for me to imagine a case where it was more clear that there was no clear state procedural rule. that waiver could apply in this situation. And I say that because the most recent pronouncement on that subject came from the Growth case, where the Wisconsin Supreme Court actually said, given the paramount importance of the integrity of the sentencing process, and I'm going into a paraphrase, whether waiver can be applied in this context remains unclear. I mean, to me, there's really no clearer case of the lack of a clear procedural rule than when the court says, you know, we don't know whether it's appropriate to apply waiver in this context or not. That is still unclear. That's a question we're not going to answer, and the court has not answered it since that time. It is true that we are here procedurally on a finding of procedural default because the district court found that there was an adequate and independent state law waiver rule and that the case was therefore in a procedural default posture. But the district court only did that because of its mistaken belief that once the state court said the word waiver, we're finding waiver here. That once the state court said that, there was no necessity to look at the waiver rule at issue and determine whether it was clearly established and regularly followed, whether it was a rule that was applied in any kind of principled manner. Because the district court believed that it wasn't necessary to make that inquiry, the district court did not make that inquiry. And that's ultimately the district court, when confronted with that mistake, granted the certificate of appealability in this case, conceding that whether there was a state law rule, procedural rule that was clearly established and regularly followed was debatable. I think it's beyond debatable. I think it really couldn't be more clear that there was no such procedural rule. The court actually said it's not clear. There have been cases cited. The respondent had cited a number of cases that bear, at most, tangential relevance to this question, many of them not waiver cases at all, cases where waiver wasn't even discussed, none of them addressing the specific question that the court in Growth said was still unclear, whether we have a waiver rule that applies in this context. And all of them predating the Growth decision, where the court said it remains unclear. I think I could scarcely imagine a case where it's more clear that there was no state procedural rule. Even if the one case cited by the state, the Johnson case, which sort of discusses due process and doesn't discuss waiver but talks about how the judge didn't abuse his discretion by relying on this unobjected to information. Even if you could sort of call a waiver rule from that case that might apply here, arguably, it certainly isn't applied in any kind of consistent, regular, principled manner when you have the court in Growth 12 years later saying whether there's a waiver rule that we can apply at all in this context is still unclear. So, you know, it is true that no one objected to that information at the time, but given what the Wisconsin court has recognized as the paramount importance of the integrity of the sentencing process and the fact that the Wisconsin court has declined to adopt any kind of a waiver rule, a strict waiver rule in this context, there is not a procedural default here.
All right. Well, and then besides the whole whether it's been waived or not, when we look at what the court said about the would have given the same sentence anyway, let me ask you this question. Is it your position that if a state court judge gives specific consideration to a factor at sentencing, later that factor turns out to be untrue, a federal court on habeas review must always order resentencing? I mean, shouldn't we engage in harmless error analysis, which is how we would, that's the context with which we would review his statement?
Yes, is the short answer to your question, and in effect, you've actually read my mind, because one of the things I was going to tell the court today is that I realized, I think belatedly, that both I and opposing counsel, I think, have conflated really what are two different issues. One being, did the court rely on this information under Tucker? Was there reliance on this information at sentencing such that due process was violated? And two, if so, applying the harmless error analysis of Brecht versus Abrahamson, was there a substantial and injurious effect from the due process violation? And I know I've been guilty of sort of conflating those two issues. And how those two standards mesh, I think, is less than completely clear. What I think I can say with confidence is that when you're applying the harmless error analysis under Brecht, what you don't do is just go ask the sentencing judge, hey, judge, would you have done anything differently, and then rely on the judge's answer to that question. And the way I know that is because that's not what this court has done. In looking specifically at the case of Burr versus Pollard, that was a case in which this court applied the Brecht harmless error standard to a situation where inaccurate information had been relied on at sentencing. And the judge in that case, just as the judge in this case, said, you know what, I didn't really rely on that. I didn't consider that. I wouldn't have done anything differently. And the court didn't stop there and simply take that assertion at face value. The court looked at the record. And the court determined, based on the record, ultimately, that the judge's mention of the information had been sort of an afterthought, that based on the record, it didn't appear that the judge had really relied on the information. But it's clear enough from this court's treatment of the issue that in applying the harmless error analysis, you don't just ask the judge, hey, looking back on it now from the perspective of hindsight, does this make a difference to you? Would you have done it differently? The record really answers that question. And the record answers that question very clearly, I believe, in this case.
What's the record answer?
The question whether the judge relied on the information at sentencing.
What does the record show? It looks to me like the record is this, whatever, 30-plus pages going through why this guy did such a horrible thing. The mention of 23 beers, you know, then blacking out, going through the victim impact, everything else, how horrible this was. And it was, what, two or three days later when he said, well, 23 wouldn't make any difference. It wasn't 7 years or whatever it was in that other case. I'm just saying that you look at the transcript here, it's pretty clear that whether it's 23 or 13 or whatever, he blacked out, did this and that, and did this horrible stuff. That's what the whole sentencing transcript says. So why is this 23... beers wasn't important enough to object to, and not only that, everything he said is pretty bad. What are you going to do? I can understand why you're grabbing onto the 23 beers, but this was a pretty horrible thing.
I agree, and I think one of the first things out of my mouth this morning was that what he did was bad enough. I mean, this was the facts of this case are terrible. Mm-hmm. And the question, though, is, are they substantially more terrible with the 23 number in there? And I would suggest that they are substantially more terrible. The trial judge cited a newspaper article in the decision on the post-conviction motion. The trial judge cited a newspaper article that says it all. The reporter said, this man, you know, he killed four people after getting in his car after drinking 23 beers, and this is the sentence he got, and yeah, I think the math sounds about right.
Now, when was the newspaper article? I missed date on this.
You know what? I'm sorry. I can't tell you.
With relation to the sentencing?
It was after the sentencing. Shortly after the sentencing.
It's a report on the sentencing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, but then the judge talked about other things. He talked about the blood alcohol level of 0.16 going 77 to 86. There is more to the record.
There certainly is. I mean, it's sort of a common theme in the decisions here and in the arguments from the other side that the judge talked for a long time, about a lot of things. And there were a lot of bad facts in this case to talk about. The question is, did this sort of outrageous allegation that this man sat down and consumed that amount of alcohol, did that contribute? Was that part of it? And I don't see how you can read this record and conclude that it wasn't part of it. It wasn't all of it. Certainly it was bad enough. But this judge overshot the prosecutor's recommendation in this case by some 30 years. And he did that based on his conclusion. He described this as and I'm quoting, the most irresponsible, reckless criminal combination of drinking and driving the court has ever seen, presided over, or read about. This was the worst OWI case in terms of conduct. And he's talking about conduct here. He's not talking about the result. He's talking about conduct. This is the worst case he's ever seen.
So the prosecutor, what, recommended 35 years?
35 to 40 years.
35 to 40, and he got 66. Let's stop here. We'll save the rest of your
time. Thank you.
I mean, you can go on, but you'll expire your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Miss, is it Moeller?
Moeller.
And is it Miss or Ms.?
May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Moeller, representing the state of Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals waiver finding in this case with respect to the due process claim was not based solely on the fact that when the 23-beer figure was mentioned at the sentencing hearing that there was no objection from the defense. It was also based on the fact that the figure the judge arrived at was provided by the defense, because the defense had commissioned its own pre-sentence investigation report. And in that pre-sentence, which was based largely on information that Mr. Promoter had given to the author of the defense PSI, he admitted drinking 15 or 16 beers out of a first 24-pack, an additional six out of the second 24-pack, and then part of one beer, and that's as much as he could remember. So the judge simply took that, added up these figures that the defense had provided, and came up with the 23 figures. And the cases that the state cited in its brief go not only to the failure of a defendant to object to incorrect information that is in a PSI, but also to the fact that there's a principle in Wisconsin law that a defendant cannot be heard to complain on appeal about action the trial court took that was based on something the defendant did or asked them to do.
Well, as I understand it, the report was not read to Mr. Promoter in Spanish before it was submitted to the judge. Is that right?
That is what Mr. Promoter alleged in his post-trial affidavit. We never had a hearing in the state trial court, so we've never heard from defense counsel as to whether counsel would refute that notion. But that is what Mr. Promoter said in his affidavit.
And the sentencing hearing, was an interpreter there? What was his level of understanding of English, Promoter?
I'm not certain. I think counsel for Mr. Promoter can answer that better. I know that he had been in the country since 1998 or 1999 and had worked a series of jobs, so he obviously had some English proficiency, but he reported to the defense PSI author that he was literate in Spanish but not in English, and that he only had, I believe it was, a sixth grade education. So I'm not really clear on how much he needed the services of an interpreter, but there was one.
There was one where?
There was one at the sentencing.
And
also there was an interpreter in conjunction with doing the PSI.
Okay.
What you mentioned, the commission did his own pre-sentence investigation. Did you say that? What did you say, something about the information?
The PSI that we're talking about here that had that allegedly incorrect information was not the official PSI that the Department of Corrections does. It was one that was commissioned as an alternative pre-sentence, which defense counsel in Wisconsin do on occasion.
Okay, that's what I was asking. So what then that and that's information he supposedly gave, and I guess following up on her question, what was the translation involved there?
The translation was that there was an interpreter who was assisting the author of the pre-sentence report in translating what Mr.
You mean the defense pre-sentence?
Yes, I'm sorry, the defense pre-sentence.
Clarify that.
Right, that's the only pre-sentence that's at issue right now in this case. There was an interpreter that the defense was using. So they're claiming that that information in the report was something that Promoter never really said, which, if that's the case, it still remains that this information came from the defense. So the principle of Wisconsin law that you cannot complain on appeal about something that you caused the trial court to do kicks in here. And the growth case that my opponent keeps citing does not address that situation. Growth only addresses the situation where you've got incorrect information in a PSI that was supplied by the state or by the prosecutor. Because in growth, the situation was incorrect information that the prosecutor injected into the sentencing proceeding, and there was no objection. But
the statement in growth, though, and growth is kind of critical here, it seems to me, it addresses waiver, doesn't it? Generically, it doesn't.
I don't think you can really just take that language out of growth.
The further question is what is the status of growth? I mean, as I understand it, this Tiepelman case came after growth. Is that right?
Tiepelman is post-growth, and growth,
well,
it's...
And it says growth. Well, it sort of says growth says that, but other cases say something different. So I don't know.
It doesn't really, right. I think growth is somewhat of an outlier, but I think the bottom line here is that this doesn't make sense under the rubric of a due process violation, because to have a due process violation, you have to have a state actor doing something that is incorrect, whether it's the prosecutor injecting false information into a sentencing proceeding, or whether it's false information being contained in an official PSI. Due process really doesn't fit this situation here at all. The only thing that would fit would be a claim that the trial attorney was guilty of ineffective assistance of counsel by failing to go over the completed defense PSI with Mr. Promoter, assuming that his allegation to this effect is correct. You'd have to really reach it through ineffective assistance of counsel. However, that is not one of the issues on which a certificate of appealability was granted. And I recognize that Promoter has asked this court to expand the COA to include that issue, but we object to that being done because the whole issue of ineffective assistance of counsel was procedurally defaulted, because that was not included in Mr. Promoter's petition for review to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And it was a petition that was drafted by counsel. And that petition for review never indicated that ineffective assistance was the issue. It only framed it in terms of due process. The district court gave a quite, I think, compelling analysis of why the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel had been procedurally defaulted by not being presented to the Wisconsin Supreme Court on direct appeal. And the court noted that even though an attorney drafted that, there was no mention of Strickland versus Washington. There was nothing in the issues presented. There was just a passing reference in the petition for review to the fact that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals had decided the issue as one of ineffective assistance. And that was it. And that really is not enough for full and fair presentment.
Let's get back to this issue of the due process claim. You've said that Tucker and Townsend don't stand for the proposition that a due process violation occurs when a court relies on erroneous information at sentencing. Do any circuits agree with you going that far?
I was not able to find a case that was that direct, but I think that if you look at the most recent pronouncements now of the United States Supreme Court in terms of what is considered to be clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court for purposes of federal habeas, that they have really narrowed the interpretation of what is clearly established as exemplified by Carey versus Musladin, and a case out of the Seventh Circuit, actually, Wright versus Van Patten. It's gotten to be that you look very specifically at the holdings and not so much on how other courts, lower federal courts, state courts, have applied Supreme Court holdings. And if you look at Tucker, there you had two or three prior convictions that were without counsel and therefore in violation of Gideon versus Wainwright. And the sentence that Tucker received was based on what the court described as misinformation of constitutional magnitude. And they pointed out that under Burgett, Gideon would be eroded if a sentence could be based on, a sentence could be enhanced based on unconstitutional convictions. So I think the facts of that case are so far removed from a situation here where any information that is allegedly false was provided by the defense, and certainly I would take issue with the contention that it was material. I don't think looking at the sentencing transcript as a whole, there was really anything material about the fact that the trial court thought Mr. Promoter had drunk 23 beers instead of 13.
Let me ask you this, and I think I know your answer to this, but if the state court judge said he was giving a defendant a long sentence largely because he had, say, two earlier murder convictions, and it turned out that the defendant didn't actually have those convictions, would that be a due process violation?
If the court said that was the specific reason why he was choosing it, yes, then I think that would be most likely that would be a due process violation.
So how do you think we should draw the line?
Well, I think, first of all, I think you should not reach the merits at all, but assuming that you do reach the merits, talk about whether this alleged erroneous fact was really material. And if you look at the sentencing transcript as a whole, I think you could insert 13 every time you see the number 23, and you would come down with exactly the same sentence that the Wisconsin sentencing judge came up with, because the sentencing transcript shows that primary consideration, I think, was that this was a very emotional case because four lives were lost, two other lives were permanently impacted by permanent physical injuries resulting from this crash. And even if you assume that Mr. Promoter only drank 13 beers in that time frame, the fact is that he was still driving 76 to 83 in a residential neighborhood. He ran two red lights. He was basically in an alcoholic blackout. He had no recollection of what had happened. And interestingly enough, the sentence for one of these felonies was the same in the PSI commissioned by the defense. The recommended sentence was pretty much the same as what the judge reached, but the difference was that the judge made the sentences consecutive to one another, and the defense PSI requested that all of the sentences for four deaths and two serious injuries be concurrent.
What did the prosecutor recommend? Counsel says the prosecution recommended 35 years.
I believe that's correct. The prosecutor recommended something like a confinement portion because these were bifurcated sentences, and I believe she is correct that the prosecutor recommended between 35 to 40 years of actual incarceration time.
Makes the argument that demonstrates the fact that the judge went almost, well, not almost double what the prosecution had recommended, that highlights and makes more critical this 23 beer conclusion.
And I disagree with that. I think that the sentencing transcript shows that this case, more than the average case, had a lot of testimony or letter writing from the family members of the six victims that were involved in this case. And I think that when the judge gave such a lengthy sentence, he specifically said he was doing it consecutively because you don't sort of get a free ride for all the victims who were affected by your conduct, and that unfortunately for Mr. Promoter, it wasn't just where he caused an accident and killed one person, but he killed four people and seriously injured two others. For the rest of our...
Back to the growth case for a moment here.
Sure.
Is the growth case, I think in terms of, the validity of the state grounds for taking the action that was taken here, consistence, application is the sort of the watchword, isn't it?
Right, whether it's applied in a consistent and principled manner, I believe, is the language.
Principle. Well, what does the Groth case do to consistency
Well, I think Groth is sort of an outlier because when I shepherdized Groth, I couldn't find any other later cases that cited it for that specific proposition about it being unclear. But even if you assume that the portion of waiver doctrine that relates to the failure to raise an objection during the sentencing hearing, even if you assume that that is unclear, it remains the fact that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals relied on a separate doctrine and called it under the rubric of waiver, but it's almost like an estoppel type of situation where you're not allowed to give wrong information to a sentencing judge and then complain because the sentencing judge relied on the wrong information you gave. And so I think Groth doesn't really address that aspect of waiver that was mentioned by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time? 1 minute.
Let's see how fast I can talk. Two things. The waiver principle that is being presented in order to get around Groth is this idea that you can't sort of cause a trial court error and then complain about it. That's the rule that's being proposed. This was really a very generous view of what the court did here, what the Court of Appeals did in terms of its sort of logic applying a waiver standard, because all the Court of Appeals said is waiver. It was waived. No citation to any kind of authority. So we're left to sort of cobble a rule together. The rule that my opponent is attempting to cobble together is based on a bunch of cases where essentially the defendant asked the court to do something, perform an in-camera inspection of some records, find a witness unavailable, I'm asking you, judge, to do these things, and then later tried to argue on appeal that the judge had erred in following his own requests. That doesn't apply to this case at all. That's not the situation we have here at all. And those cases certainly don't trump the statement in Groth. And that question that was left open, you know, Tiepelman discusses it. The question has never been answered. It's just sort of hanging out there. And trying to sort of sidestep it with a waiver rule that doesn't really apply doesn't do the job, doesn't mean that there's a waiver rule that's consistently applied.
Thank you. Were you appointed in this case?
I was.
You were. We thank you for your fine representation of your client and your thorough brief. We thank you, counsel, for your brief and for your oral argument. We'll take the case under advisement. Thank you.